This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
We need a government of national unity led by an honest, not corrupt president that is acceptable to all of the Malians. And Malians, I think, have a tendency toward unity. And we have to get back to that. We have to listen to them, and we have to respect them.
That's Vicky Huddleston, a former U.S. ambassador to Mali, on the best way forward for the country after last week's coup. Details coming up also. Rwanda has issued an arrest warrant for a former military intelligence official accused of playing a key role in the 1994 genocide. And Senegalese President Macky Sall is in France for a two-day visit. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. The military junta that staged a coup in Mali last week says it will release ousted President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita and plans to rule for 3 years as part of a transitional government. However, international observers say military-led rule isn't the way forward in the troubled country and fear instability could spread across West Africa. VOA's Mariama Diallo spoke to international observers and VOA's Salem Salomon spoke to former U.S. Ambassador to Mali, Vicky Huddleston.
After a coup that led to the resignation of Mali's president, the international community is watching closely and debating how best to help the West African country avoid collapse. Vicky Huddleston, a former U.S. ambassador to Mali, said the key is to support the Malian people in forming a government that is trusted and representative of the country's diversity.
We need a government of national unity led by an honest, not corrupt president that is acceptable to all of the Malians. And Malians, I think, have a tendency toward unity. And we have to get back to that. We have to listen to them and we have to respect them.
The Malian soldiers who orchestrated the coup pledged to relinquish power and to organize general elections. Huddleston said the international community must hold them to that promise.
What the United States, France, European Union, and the AU with ECOWAS need to tell the military, you stand down or you will be fighting us. The military has to stand down. That cannot stand. But the most important thing is to get the military back into the barracks, whatever it takes.
International pressure has been swift. The African Union voted to suspend Mali's membership. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has condemned the mutiny and called for all parties to engage in dialogue. ECOWAS, the 15-member economic community of West African states, condemned the coup and sent a delegation of heads of state to try to broker a peaceful way forward. The moment is particularly perilous for West Africa, with hotly contested elections this year in Ivory Coast, Guinea, Ghana, and Burkina Faso. Jude Moore is a senior policy fellow at the Center for Global Development.
The stability of the region is really, really important. To see Mali fail and Mali fall when you have all of these events coming that might bring instability is worrisome for the regional group. And so that's why I think the response was so muscular.
Mass protests erupted earlier this year following a decision by Mali's constitutional court to overturn the results of parliamentary elections. Following Keita's ouster, some are holding out hope there is an opening for progress. Joe Shoyer is a resident representative for the UNDP in Mali.
As such, military coups are not the preferred way of dealing with crisis in the country. The UN, as you probably know, at the level of the Secretary General, has issued a statement also condemning the coup. And of course, potentially, it has a very big impact that could go in both of two directions, really. It could get worse in terms of the trajectory of the country. But at the same time, you know, a crisis is also an opportunity. Depending how this develops, perhaps it might turn out in the long term as something that might address some of the underlying reasons why the coup was actually seemed necessary by those that led to the event.
Leaders from the ECOWAS region have met with the military junta and failed to reach an agreement on transition. However, they hope that power will return to civilian control. With Mariama Diallo, Salem Solomon, VOA News, Washington.
The Speaker of Libya's Parliament in the East, Aguila Saleh, and the Government of National Accord in Tripoli issued similar ceasefire proposals at the same time. But there's no agreement on the biggest issues, a political path towards stabilization or the demilitarization of Sirte. The GNA, headed by Faiz al-Sarj, is facing a wave of street protests over corruption, deterioration of economic situation, and lack of services. VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi discussed these developments with Wolfgang Porstai, a former Austrian military attaché in Libya.
For the GNA, there are currently two different challenges. Number one, and the immediate problem for Sarraj, is how to appease the civilian protesters who are rioting in Tripoli and some other western cities since a couple of days because of corruption and the difficult living circumstances. That's the immediate problem for Sarraj and the GNA. Sarraj has announced cabinet reshuffle. We'll see if this will appease the protesters. Although there are some people demanding him to resign, I would say it is rather unlikely that Sarraj himself will be replaced, because replacing him could cost the Government of National Accord its international recognition. The number two problem, the problem for the whole of Libya, is how to find some kind of settlement between the East and the West. Right now, it looks more after endless negotiations without a real progress. There are simply many, maybe too many, differences between Sarraj and Saleh about the way ahead. Sarraj wants to continue with the current presidential council. Saleh insists on a new one with one member of each region. Saleh wants to move the government to Sirte, a no-go for Sarraj. Sarraj wants to continue along the Shkirat agreement. Saleh seeks to follow the Cairo declaration. Sarraj seeks for and wants to maintain a centralized state. Saleh looks for decentralization. Saleh doesn't really see a fixed date for elections, while Sarraj wants to have elections already next March. But the preconditions for elections are a certain amount of stability. It is doubtful that elections would be fair without a close international supervision. Nevertheless, and I would like to stress this, as the positions between the current actors, especially between Sarraj and Saleh, are deadlocked, maybe elections could bring some movement, even if they are not perfect. At the very end, I would say the only one realistic way forward is a federalist approach.
But would Berlin Conference provide a plan for peace without preconditions?
Well, the Berlin process and the subsequent Geneva talks, they are still based on the Shkirat Agreement. They are based to continue with the Shkirat Agreement and to continue from there. I think it would certainly make sense to continue with this process, but to move gradually and slowly away to some kind of new solution. Unfortunately, right now, the situation is still in a political deadlock. So it's necessary to move slowly away from this Shkirat process to a new direction. And elections, as proposed frequently by Ansmil, maybe, as I said, even if they are not perfect, could get things moving.
That was Wolfgang Porstai, a former Austrian military attaché in Libya, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi. Rwanda has issued an arrest warrant for former military intelligence official Aloy Intwiragabo, accused of playing a key role in the 1994 genocide. Media reports in France say Rwanda's prosecutor general is asking that France expedite the 72-year-old Intwiragabo, who was found living in the city of Orleans. VOA Steve Miller spoke with reporter Catherine Field in Paris, who notes that France has never extradited a genocide suspect to Kigali.
This is an extradition warrant for a genocide suspect, Mr. Intwiragabo, who was the head of military intelligence in Rwanda in the period leading up to 1994. What we've heard is the prosecutor general in Rwanda has asked the French judicial system, and that's not just the courts, but also a special office here in Paris that deals with crimes against humanity, has asked that he be arrested and be put on a plane back to Rwanda. They say that since they got the reports in July that this former military intelligence official was in France, they have put together a dossier, and in that dossier are 25 witness statements that the Rwandan authorities say is proof enough that he needs to stand trial in Rwanda for these alleged crimes.
What's been the response by Mr. Nitawera Gabo's lawyers pertaining to this extradition request?
His lawyers messaged me a few hours ago saying that they had no comment to make. They said they weren't up to speed with these developments. However, when this first came to light here in France at the end of July, they did say that their client was innocent of the charges that had been put forward.
So moving forward, since this is apparently a warrant for extradition, what's the process that the accused will go through?
Well, at the moment, there are two processes that are going side by side. One is the French authorities, who have opened a formal investigation into the allegations that during the genocide, that this military intelligence chief was one of the people who participated in daily meetings at which there was the planning, preparation, or execution of a scheme to commit atrocities. So that is what the French are investigating. The suspect has not yet been formally arrested, so that is going through. The Rwandans are saying, we can arrest him today. Here is the document. Hand him over. This could prove difficult because traditionally France, unlike some other European nations, has not handed over suspects. It is preferred to keep them here in France, if necessary, put them on trial here, or hand them over to the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, the mechanism, as it's called. However, and this is where Rwandan officials say that they may have a chance of this, of getting their suspect back to Rwanda. In 2004, that International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda dropped all their cases against this suspect. No one knows for sure why, but he is not wanted by the mechanism at the moment. So it is a bit of a race against time, and it could well show exactly what the current French president, Emmanuel Macron, means when he says that the current French government has turned a page when it comes to its relationship with Rwanda.
Now, Catherine, this isn't the only high-profile case dealing with the Rwandan genocide in France. What can you tell us about that other case and where things stand right now?
Felicien Kabuga has been ordered to be handed over to the International Criminal Tribunal. He comes before a French court next week for his final hearing. So on the 2nd of September, we will hear whether or not he will be handed over. That is another crucial date. We've also heard in the last 24 hours that officials from that tribunal have arrived in Rwanda for a month-long investigation into those alleged crimes. So we're seeing these two, what has been known as the big fish of the for the genocide, coming to the fore, being investigated. And that's really what Rwanda has been demanding for all these years, that France play a role, turn the page, and not give what they allege to be a secret home for these Rwandan suspects since the Rwandan genocide.
Senegal President Macky Sall is in France for a two-day visit. He met today with French counterpart Emmanuel Macron to discuss the economy and the coup in Mali. Nicolas Pinon has more from Paris.
The meeting was supposed to take place in Dakar in June, but was postponed due to the coronavirus outbreak. Sall stayed less than 2 hours at the Elysee Palace to meet with Macron, but no joint statement was issued afterward. But the coup in Mali has been high on both men's agendas. They condemned the soldiers, who staged a mutiny and arrested President Ibrahim Boubacar Keïta, who then resigned and dissolved parliament, throwing the country into further turmoil. Also among these bilateral discussions were the overall stability in West Africa, as the region braces for tensions with the issue of the third election mandates sought by Alpha Condé in Guinea and Alassane Ouattara in Ivory Coast. Tomorrow, the Senegalese president will give a major speech in front of French businessmen on the impact of COVID-19 pandemic. Sall is scheduled to fly back to Dakar on Friday. Nicolas Pinault, VOA News, Paris.
Ugandan authorities are concerned about an increase in suicides across the country, with most attributed to the hard living conditions and the COVID-19 lockdown. Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
In January through June, police registered 275 suicides, a sharp rise from 224 for all of last year. Most victims were between 17 and 48 years old. Police investigations say high levels of frustration and hopelessness were cited in communities during the lockdown imposed in March to stem the spread of COVID-19. Paul Enamaye is the deputy Uganda police spokesperson.
We suspect and believe that these increases in the cases of suicide could be related to a number of issues that people are facing, especially during lockdown. Such as frustration, stress, self-rejection. Of course, people have not been working. Some of them, business has really slowed down. So poverty is on the increase.
Uganda is gradually lifting the lockdown, even though cases are rising. A number of people have lost their jobs or seen their salaries slashed, while others are struggling in businesses due to the impact of COVID-19. Mental health experts are predicting a further rise in suicides as a form of protest or expression of emotional distress if people aren't cushioned from the negative impacts. George William Ochom is a lecturer of sociology at Makerere University.
Indeed, due to the fact that the people are demoralized, people are now trying to use that negative way of solving problems. And if the behavior is not checked or if there is no intervention put in place to help people to understand that problems can be solved easily, we are going to see a number of those incidents. We shall find that there are many killings. We shall also find that people are having a lot of arson and killing themselves.
Dr. Rachel Alinitwe is a psychiatrist. She says the high suicide rates call for more action from the authorities and the community at large to address the mental health challenges faced by society at large.
So you come back to work, but you have so much, you know, financial implications to income. Taxes, rent. You hear traders talking all the time that they want to be helped out. It is key that we reach out to those people or find someone you know they can trust to open up to.
Statistics indicate one person dies by suicide every 40 seconds around the world, more deaths than those from war and homicides combined, and the second leading cause of deaths among the youth behind road injuries. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
Officials in Zimbabwe's capital say they are facing a severe water shortage and public health concerns as water levels and dams supplying Harare have drastically dropped during the COVID-19 pandemic. Charities have stepped up free water deliveries to poor neighborhoods, but authorities say social distancing is a challenge at public water points. Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare.
Recurring droughts and failure to import water treatment chemicals has resulted in some parts of Harare without tap water. Residents have to depend on open water sources or overcrowded, manually pumped bowls. 23-year-old Chester Musha is one of those that wake up around 3 a.m. to queue for water, or the bowl dries up that day.
We really need serious assistance because you see people are disregarding the coronavirus, whatever measures put on to keep us safe. Constitutionally, I know we are entitled to safety health, safety environment, but this is not giving us that as promised by the Constitution. And also, we cannot sit there and relax. Recently, we had a girl from South Africa. She was under home quarantine, and she had no water, she had no electricity, and you cannot expect a person to live under such circumstances. So we really need serious assistance here in Mafuku.
In some areas, underground water tables have gone down and boreholes are struggling to provide the precious water. Some organizations like Clean City have chipped in with 4 buckets of free water per family. 45-year-old Florence Piri says residents appreciate that gesture. But my appeal to Clean City is that they must increase the number of bowsers that bring water here, because sometimes some people go home with no water, she says. That results in them looking for water in open sources like wells. Our troubles are less when they come, but we wish Clean City would come daily. They are really helping us. If they keep coming, we'll be able to contain COVID-19 in this area, she adds. Clean City said it would not comment on residents' appeal for more supplies of water. Michael Chideme is the spokesman for the city of Harare. He says Zimbabwe's capital is failing to get adequate foreign currency needed to import $3 million worth of water treating chemicals every month.
So we end up buying very little and also treating restricted amounts of water so that we can last longer with the chemicals that we have. Our other problem is to do with our water bodies, Sege and Araba Dam, which complement the Manyame and Lake Chivero dams, have already dried up. We also have the problem of a dilapidated water reticulation system. Most of our pipes were laid back in the 1970s or early 80s, and now they've outlived their lifespan, hence the water burst that we are experiencing almost on a daily basis.
With rains not expected until October in Zimbabwe, that means Harare's water shortages are likely to worsen. That certainly should be bad news when the country is battling to contain coronavirus, which requires strict hygiene practices. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyu Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokpilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing The Voice of America.
Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on the radio or online at voanews.com/PCUSA. While you're visiting our website, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. We'd also love to hear from you. Just send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA or on Twitter at CarolCastielVOA. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.